it's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos, maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Tony said that he has a plan, Craig, but he needs to talk to you first. Are you okay no matter what inning you pitch or whatever, considering they're in first place and have championship?
I think I need to talk to Tony before I answer that question.
All right. We got time today to talk to Tony. He's probably sitting in a sauna trying to recover from that race he ran yesterday to get out to home plate and
that was
push
awesome.
The catcher. And by the way,
he rushed Roberto Perez. He rushed him, man.
He did. And yeah. We've loved Lance Lynn on this show. And Lance Lynn yesterday after the game, high-kneeing his ass off getting out there. I loved it. You know, that's who Tony is, and that's what we love about him. High-kneeing his ass off getting out there. That is just so funny. And then everybody else younger than Tony made jokes about, this is what it's like when I have to go. I know my former boss, Mike Kellums, did that. This is what it looks like when I have to go. Alrighty then. Welcome in, welcome back. Saturday Suckage, Steve Rosenblum, Mark Rohde with you. We go to the Scores Hotline. It is presented by Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. And we're going to welcome back to the show Jim Margulis of Sox Machine. The White Sox, in first place, made a trade Jim said they should look at. Jim previously said they should look at, not after the fact. He first guessed this whole thing about acquiring a second baseman, Cesar Hernandez. Jim, so prescient. Do you have lottery numbers for us? Go back to that tie. Welcome to the score. Welcome back. And the idea of the White Sox trading, they trade with the second place team and they trade with the team across town. This just seems like a whole new brave world that Rick Hahn is doing everything he can. What did you think about what they did with Cleveland?
I was surprised, or at least a little bit surprised, just because I don't know the etiquette among GMs of asking like your most direct rival and the team chasing you in the division for one of their players who have been contributing to their cause. You know, if there's just like kind of a disagreement over whether you're 9 games back, you're barely over 500, give us your second baseman. Like, I don't know if that's rude or if that's just a case where everybody sees reality the same way and it's more about getting value. But when you looked at Hernandez's skill set, being a switch hitter, being somebody who can hit right-handed pitching historically, he's a little bit down this year. He hits fly balls, which a lot of the White Sox lineup has a problem with. He complemented the rest of the lineup in a way that, you know, Nick Madrigal did before he got injured. You know, Madrigal didn't strike out. He could hit righty, so he offered his own way to complement the lineup from second base. Hernandez does the same thing, just a little bit differently. So when you factor in his defense, which has been gold glove good, it's a little bit down this year. I think right now you can pretty much consider him to be like average at best at second base. Like, that's fine. That's better than what they had with Larry Garcia filling in there. So when you factor in the price, what he's owed, the option for next year, should he be a great fit for this team, especially now with Madrigal gone afterwards, he just made a lot of sense.
We definitely don't have to ask you what Craig Kimbrell will mean to the White Sox. I mean, I think that's pretty obvious. But one of the things that Rick Hahn revealed yesterday in his conversations with Jed Hoyer of the Cubs in that conversation was that they argued over Nick Madrigal, and that, you know, Hoyer was insistent upon that. I think Rick at least made it sound like he resisted. What do you think about the White Sox losing Nick Madrigal?
Well, it really shocked me, first of all, just because I didn't think he would have trade value or enough trade value to get somebody they wanted, given that he's injured for the rest of the year. So I just really hadn't factored him into my calculus when figuring out, like, who's expendable, who can they give up, who can they replace from within or cheaply from outside. But when he was traded, you know, when I saw the news, it didn't strike me, like, emotionally in either way, just because when I factored in Hernandez, you know, possibly being picked up, and even after they traded for him with that team option for next year, I thought, well, that gives them the flexibility to trade Madrigal, because as good as Madrigal can be, and as good as he is in some regards already, you know, he's just had three significant injuries in 4 years. He had the broken wrist at Oregon State, he had the separated shoulder last year, and now he has the hamstring tendon tear this year. And when you factor in like all those, you know, surgery requiring events for a guy this young and a guy who's so reliant on maxing out his effort and his physical skills, be they what little power he has and the speed that he has, I just wonder if that's a guy who's going to have a shorter shelf life than they originally imagined when they drafted him fourth overall. It kind of brings to mind Adam Eaton, who they traded after a great season, an all-star season, or the equivalent of, and he was worth 6 wins above replacement, which is starts to border on MVP talk if he were on a winning team. You know, they traded him what seemed like unnecessarily, given that they had team control, but, you know, given the events of 2016, you know, that made it a bit easier. But also, just given his skill set, given how much he needs to max out his power and his effort and his speed, like when he had the knee injury first month into his time with Washington, he wasn't the same player afterwards. He was a fine player, an adequate starter, but he just wasn't that difference maker. And because the White Sox traded him earlier than they had to, they have Lucas Giolito, and now they have Lance Lynn through Dane Dunning. So that's kind of what struck me. I'm a little bit uncomfortable trading Madrigal just because I don't think the White Sox saw the best from him. I think he was just starting to come into his own. However, if they did trade him a year early versus a year too late, like the Branch Rickey saying is, then this is what it feels like to trade a guy a year too early.
We're talking with Jim Margulis of Sox Machine. You can read him today on SoxMachine.com, trading Nick Madrigal, why now or why not? So moving on from that, and Cesar Hernandez went 2-for-5 yesterday, and in his Sox debut against scored a run against a team that traded him. As this team gets put back together, with Eloy being hurt, and it's cringeworthy all the time, and then the pitch that Jose Abreu took to the head and set off Tony La Russa and the as he was going to get in on that battle, and keeping this team healthy, getting this roster healthy to October, I fear every time Eloy Jimenez has to go out to left field. I just think that's baseball malpractice. But I know that after what happened to Abreu, he's going to need days off, and so is Grandal. How do you handle this? What do you think is the smart play, the smart way to do this with the many moving parts the Sox will have?
Well, I think I start by giving Tony La Russa and, you know, Ethan Katz and whoever's making decisions about playing time, you know, who's ever in the office, the benefit of the doubts when it comes to weird lineups. Like seeing Andrew Vaughn at second base the last game in Kansas City, which was really odd. But then, you know, I guess Abreu had a neck issue and Anderson got a day off and Mankata was DHing. And yeah, I guess this is the luxury of a lead that's now 9 games, is that you can prioritize health. So if Eloy's groin is bothering him, like, he doesn't need to touch the lineup, he can DH, and you don't have to fight him about DHing. You can just say, like, you can't run right now. You know, be a DH. Same thing with Abreu taking a pitch to the head. I know his mom hates when he's out of the lineup, that's what keeps him staying in the game when maybe he should take a breather. But, you know, you can say, like, we need you for October, and you're going to be playing, you know, we plan to play deep into October. You're getting a day off. So I think when you see weird lineups, there's always a lot of lineup angst whenever the White Sox post it on Twitter and seeing who's batting fifth or who's batting second and getting angry about it. But I think for the time being, you know, this is the luxury of having that huge cushion, is just being able to try to keep guys fresh, but also not, you know, making sure they rust away or never find a groove. So there's a tricky balance to strike. I too cringe when Jimenez is out and left, but you know, given that, you know, Vaughn has looked a bit shaky in the outfield as of late, you know, there might be some fatigue setting in for him, given that it's his first full season. Last year really didn't do anything for him, so he's going through a grind himself. I think there's a lot of opportunity just to rotate guys in and out, occasionally having some uncomfortable moments and awkward plays and bad defense and such. But I think the priority just has to be keeping guys in the loop and understanding what their roles are going into October.
Yeah, oh my God, I can't imagine what Andrew Vaughn was thinking when he was standing playing second base the other day. Or it seemed like a shock to his system even going to right field, and he did have a ball go off his glove at one point. So point well taken. I do want to ask you kind of a follow-up on Tony La Russa, and you mentioned that he's, you're giving him the benefit of the doubt when it comes to lineup construction. The second part of that is, do you think that La Russa has become more embraceable as the season has gone on by fans who initially did not like the hiring?
I think there's a little bit of time healing wounds in that, even if and people had a right to feel potentially upset, potentially offended by his hire, depending on their past experiences, because multiple DUI charges are no joke. So they felt like that was hidden, and it was a bad way to hire a guy. Like the anger is understandable, and some people may not be able to let that go, and that's that's part of the risk of hiring him. But when it comes to just the idea, if you could set that aside and just talk about like the baseball merits in hiring somebody who's been out of the game for 9 years and made controversial comments and didn't seem like somebody who is tolerant of players expressing themselves, I think the results speak for themselves, not only in that the White Sox are in first place, but that the White Sox have been able to express themselves. Tim Anderson's been able to talk back a little bit. Lance Lynn's been able to make comments. They've been able to poke fun at him. They made fun of him, or like he made fun of himself when he was wearing the new City Connect uniforms, tilting his cap to the side. I think the Yermín Mercedes flare-up and his poor handling of that was a point of the season where it could have taken a turn for the worse. But I think part of La Russa's strength is being able to handle conflict and be the bad guy and not care about being the bad guy and not hold grudges that people don't like him. And so, like, even if, he was wrong for the way he handled it and he didn't have his players back and that was really strange, like a week later, he didn't get mad or hold grudges for people who were upset about him. He let it go. It seems like they've let it go. It seems like, he's putting players in position to succeed. Like, you think of all the role players and rookies that have run through and getting useful weeks out of them before the league figures them out and then being able to rotate to the next man up. I think that has a lot to do with the tone being set, or him, whether it's him setting the tone or whether it's letting players, a clubhouse leader, set the tone and getting out of the way. I think there is I wouldn't even call it like an uneasy alliance now. I just think they've grown to understand each other. And at this point, I think you have to trust the players who, seem to enjoy, poking fun at them but ultimately enjoy the way the season's going and let it go from there.
We're the bad kids, Tim Anderson said.
Yeah,
that's right.
Then they have to get disciplined. We're talking with Jim Margulis of Sox Machine. I don't know that it has been asked. I don't know that any baseball executive on the trade deadline day would answer it honestly, but I've never been one to underestimate the stupidity of baseball owners, nor have I been one to underestimate them under Rob Manfred's direction. So The White Sox went about doing what they needed to do. They saw what we saw, second base, the bullpen, we need to go do this. And Kenny Williams and Rick Hahn said they played their Desert Island game, and the one guy they needed, if they could only get one, was Craig Kimbrel. So they saw what we saw. I don't know if any of this is sped up by the fact that there may be no baseball next year. There is a CBA that expires December 1st. And again, never underestimating the stupidity, you have no idea where this goes. Your best chance to win this year's World Series is this year, and it may be for a while. Do you think that factored in? Did you hear anybody talk about that? What do you think about that concept?
I think there is a loose concern about that. It doesn't seem, or based on previous negotiations with the CBA, they've courted disaster for a couple of negotiation cycles now, and then it seems like by the last week, that's when the pressures of the deadline force both sides to the table and they get something done. So I think there's some rhetoric that's maybe a bit overstated right now, just because it always seems like baseball's on the brink of its first work stoppage. And then when you think about like labor relations in general, sometimes work stoppages are healthy just to reset some terms that maybe have gotten away, too far away from what one side wants. So, you know, there's that. I think some of the moves they've made, like, say, trading Dane Dunning for Lance Lynn and, you know, 6 years of team control for, at the time, 1 year, and they've since extended them. I think that was something that just said, like, let's max out 2021. I think that the Kimbrel move is kind of a spiritual brother of that trade, in which they have Madrigal for five more years, but they don't exactly know what shape he's going to come back in. So they see an opportunity to get Cesar Hernandez to fill in the spot for him this year when Madrigal can't help anymore. And then they see Kimbrel coming in and seeing how that he could perhaps help more than anybody for their specific needs, and just say, this year is enough. And I think, you know, there are CBA pressures that say, like, well, we don't know how young players are going to be paid. We don't know what the team control is going to mean anymore for players who have yet to hit arbitration. We don't know what arbitration is going to look like. So maybe it's not worth prioritizing them. But I also think, just in the way we've seen Jerry Reinsdorf operates outside of labor context, he's not somebody who spends money to make money when it comes to the White Sox, but he's somebody who will spend money if he's made money. Like, when they won the World Series, they were carrying a top five payroll. Now, I think the idea of a top five payroll, maybe the Dodgers have blown that out of proportion a little bit, yes, and made it unattainable, but at least like top 10, above average, whatever you want to call it, 150 to 170 million, something like that, is within reach. But I think you have to maximize what you do in 2021. And I think we're seeing it right now with these great weekend crowds they've drawn, with the TV ratings being up 123% over 2019, what it was then. I think there's a lot of, you know, even if you take out the CBA stuff, I think there's a lot of motivation to make the most out of this year, to have a deep October run, to boost season ticket sales, to boost interest, to take over Chicago while the Cubs are down, to get all the Fairweather fans over on their side and get their interest, in order to keep spending that money and have more, having deeper pockets to go into to address needs in the offseason. So I think this is a case where they didn't quite spend money to make money, but at least they've spent, like, future money, or they spent, like, I guess, future prospect value in a way to convert it to their payroll this year. And I think the idea is that Kimbrel and Lynn, you know, Lynn's already signed the extension, so there's that. But I think their idea is that, you know, the production they provide this year will help pay themselves back.
All right, so how do you line it up, man? Kimbrel, Hendricks, Kopech, what would you like to see?
Well, I think with Kimbrel and Hendricks, just whoever is, you know, I guess when it comes to comfort, I would like to see Kimbrel maybe get a save situation early to show that, hey, we like him in this situation too. Kind of like whenever they brought Eloy back, he batted cleanup his first game back. Hernandez, they batted him second first game back, first game with the White Sox. I think there's an idea to say, here's why we got you, to close out a game if we need you. So here you go. Have at it. Didn't really work for Ryan Tepera in the eighth inning. That was a very poor first impression. But I think that's the idea of when they have a new guy who they're counting on to deliver, they try to put them in that role as early as possible. But we'll see if there are any egos involved. I think Hendricks just likes getting the ball whenever and likes pitching multiple innings, so he might be more amenable to a looser usage, especially since, like, with before he turned into a super closer with Oakland, he was kind of that guy. He has recent experience. I think what I'm looking forward to is seeing how they use Kopech, because, you know, assuming Tapera's, you know, first outing was an aberration, and Aaron Bummer looks better as of late, you have the freedom to stretch out Kopech again for multiple innings, maybe using him as a spot starter to give some of your starters, like, you know, Carlos Rodon and Dallas Keuchel, a breather when they need it. You know, that could be helpful. But also, just I'm thinking in October, like, say if you have to start Keuchel or Cease for a game and you don't feel great about them, you feel okay about them going four, you don't feel great about them going six, can you give the ball to Kopech to come in and get through the sixth or seventh himself, just because he's been stretched out? That's, I think, a weapon that many teams don't have. The Dodgers kind of had that last year with Urias, and I think the White Sox could do something similar with Kopech, which also, you know, solves the problem of next year. Should they need a starter, should Rodon leave, having the ability to have him stretch out, have him be over 100 innings, and having the idea of him starting 25 to 30 games not be such a stretch.
Jim, we thank you for your time. We'll have you back when it's clear the White Sox have turned every game into a two-inning game, and then they've just thrown 100 miles an hour out there. Jim, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
All right. Jim Margulis of Sox Machine, SoxMachine.com. We'll take a break. When we come back, you know what? Mark heard a lot this week. We need to know what Mark heard. Mark, you heard a lot, right?
All Bears. I will give you the best of the Bears from this week. I've been out there every day except for today. And I will play for you some very entertaining sound bites from some very entertaining Bears players.
I love this. All right. Yeah. I can't wait. Yep. We'll find out what Mark heard next on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And you're seeing exactly
you know why it's not
outside of Cleveland.
You know,
think of the Browns, outside of
Browns. You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Rack and Yak.
It's time for What Mark Heard on Saturday Suckage with Mark Grody and Steve Rosenblum.
Boy, everyone is stupid except me.
Indeed, and except Mark. And here's Mark Grody because this is our near award-winning segment, What Mark Heard. Mark, what did you heard?
Well, I heard and I learned. One thing that I learned earlier this week, that it is okay to say to Robert Quinn's face, if you would like, that he had a bad year last year. You have to listen very carefully to what Robert Quinn said in some of the interaction with a reporter who asked the question. Take a listen.
Robert, you said last year, I'm sorry, I don't want to misquote you, but you said it wasn't a good year or a bad year for you.
No, it was a bad year.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to use the wrong word.
No, it was, I mean, unless you like those type stats, but I mean, again, I was guessing might have been just kind of hard on myself because I got high expectations. I might have just beat myself down mentally, but I mean, I guess at the end of the day, I can erase 2020 because, well, put it behind me because, you know, again, it's on and over with, so. Now I can look forward to this year coming with a little more, a better positive mindset, a little more energetic, you know, happy mindset, and, you know, try to give, you know, the Bears and my teammates and, you know, everyone the best version of myself as a person and player, and, you know, hopefully they get what they're looking for.
I know it's a long training camp, Robert, but are you feeling pressure as you come in? Are you feeling that pressure?
Well, here's the thing about pressure. Bust pipes will make diamonds. I don't got any diamonds on now, but I can steal my ears. It's starting to glisten. Can I borrow yours? Like, no, I mean, it's really no pressure. I mean, this is my 11th year. Like, what pressure? Like, I mean, what pressure? I guess the only pressure I put on myself is my, you know, my self-standard. So, you know, from outside people, I can really care less what y'all think because, again, I got my own expectations for myself, and, you know, that's all that really matters to me.
Steve, how much did you love him saying, unless you think that was good, what I did last year?
Well, I'm glad that he admitted it, that he sucked. And the question is, why? Was there other parts of his that interview session where he explained why he sucked?
Not really. I mean, I think he may have been enabled, you know, in regards to a question about injuries, but he would not use that.
Oh,
as an excuse.
Okay, that's good.
So, yeah, I mean, no, there was no real concrete answer as to why he wasn't better than Leonard Floyd last year. So, yeah, and now.
Dude, that hurts.
Yeah, I mean, and I know that a lot of times words are words, but those are some pretty exact words, and it's rare when, you know, an athlete will defend the reporter and say, no, dude, don't weaken your words. I was bad last year. So
yeah, we talked about that a lot last year, and you were watching on the sideline, and he was a guy who you talked about. I remember saying that he was somebody there was an honesty there, and I guess that we just saw another version of that, and that's good. I still, the big question to me is why, and how do both he and Sean Desai make it different?
Right, and I don't know, and we shall see. I mean, I'm still getting to know Sean Desai and watching how he does business. Interestingly enough, Sean Desai, who everybody breathlessly knows, is a disciple of Vic Fangio. But yesterday, when we talked to Sean Desai for the first time, he, while showing full respect for Vic Fangio and admitting that he is a mentor, he did kind of scoff at the idea that everybody is just assuming he is going to be Vic Fangio and do things exactly as Vic Fangio did. He's rejecting that theme yesterday. So it's wait and see. I don't know what Sean Desai will be like as the defensive coordinator of the Bears, and he essentially told us that yesterday. I mean, the one thing that they have said – go ahead, Steve.
No, I kind of like that answer where you were. I kind of like that answer. I don't know if he meant it this way, but the subtext I read, heard, the idea that I'm not going to do that because there's not – while there might be a profile – every year is different, every player is different, every situation is different. And I think we saw Vic Fangio coach based on opportunity, situation, what he knew his players could do, what he thought his players could do. So I kind of like that response from Sean Desai.
Yeah, absolutely, because you have to, as Matt Nagy has found out, you have to cater to the players that you have on the field. The skill sets that exist and what Sean Desai has to account for is essentially aging in some cases. You know, I mean, you do have an aging Robert Quinn. None of these guys are old, but aging and maybe diminishing in skills to some degree. And how do I get... And here's a good thing that Bears fans should know, and maybe you already know, that Sean Desai, he coached safeties. So, and Eddie Jackson was one of his star pupils, and he did not have an Eddie Jackson year last year. So it's probably good that that connection is made, that, you know, if anybody can get Eddie Jackson back to where he once was, as in 2018 and for maybe parts of 2019, then it's Sean Desai. And that's an observation that I made in watching camp, I think it was yesterday, Eddie Jackson not participating, but he's out there in shorts and standing on the sideline. I saw him getting in the ear of Sean Desai a lot. And so he's involved and earnest and all of that kind of stuff. So I think that that's, you know, it's peripheral and it doesn't mean a lot to fans, but it exists.
Okay. All right. Good start. So what else did Mark hear?
Okay. Mark also heard from Khalil Mack. Take a listen to Khalil Mack.
You guys said last year that the defense wasn't as good as you had hoped it would be. Was that on players? Was that a scheme reason? What came together to kind of make it that way, and how do you fix it?
For me, it sounds like excuses. But for me personally, I know I could play better. So ultimately, what I can control is what I can control, you know what I mean? And that's everybody's approach to this season. What you can control is what you control, but what you bring to the table, man, we got to bring it all together and be what we know we can be. And
that is Khalil Mack right there, and I apologize for the abrupt ending to it. I had forgotten that he says a bad word at the end, so I wanted to save everybody's jobs here.
Good idea.
So
we appreciate
yeah,
that.
But Khalil Mack again, plain spoken, and you know he does not visit the media much these days. And again, another guy who, as far as the injuries, because he popped up on the injury report a ton last year, but still played through it. He was asked specifically about, hey, man, were you healthy? And he said, if I was out there, then I was 100%. So I don't know if that is true, but this is a dude who really knows that words don't matter. So I don't know what that does for you or Bears fans, but Mack is like, let's go. I don't care. I don't need to talk about this.
It doesn't change anything about the way I view him, his spirit, the way he plays, the way he plays through whatever he's going to play. But again, I asked the same question about that pass rusher that I asked about Robert Quinn, the why. We didn't get the why. He didn't want to use it. I think he views every why
right.
answer as an excuse. And he didn't want to use it. And so we're not going to get the why from him. We don't get much from him anyways. We're going to get performance. And we're going to get our answers on the field. I mean, that's pretty much the way he has been and what he is, the way Bears fans have seen him. I still like to know the why. But we're not going to get that, I don't think.
Yeah, again, we tried to get the why. And enabling with injuries, but he'll not have it. So, yeah. Would you like to get to Justin Fields now? How about Justin Fields?
Who?
Yeah, he is this.
Was he an undrafted free agent they signed?
No, he was the first round pick out of Ohio State University. Quarterback.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. But anyway,
The Ohio State.
Really? Yes. Big time prospect. The Bears apparently moved up on draft day to get Justin Fields. And Justin Fields, by the way, has not spoken in camp as of yet, unless he is today. And that I don't think he has yet, but that could he eventually will. But he has not yet. So for now, we have the Bears head coach, Matt Nagy, speaking of Justin Fields and how he plans on challenging this mysterious quarterback you speak of.
The stuff that Flip does behind the scenes with the different tests that he gives, when they're watching tape and going through different coverages, trying to understand post-snap what teams are showing, fronts. But really, in the end, when it comes down to it, are you making plays now in the team periods, in 7-on-7 in training camp, the reps that we get in the team periods, situationally, where are you situationally, you know? So that's probably the biggest test, and then the rest of it is just kind of more of what every quarterback coach does in the league and what Justin's going to have to do along with Nick and Andy.
And watching Justin Fields the last 2 days, here's my observations. 2 days ago, he had a rough day. He had a fumble or a bad pitch to Artavis Pierce. He was missing guys. Andy Dalton looked better than Justin Fields. Yesterday, Justin Fields looked really sharp in 7-on-7s. A couple bullets up the middle, one to Jesse James, the new tight end. Another to Thomas Ives, a local kid, as a matter of fact, Thomas Ives. He looked a little bit more conservative in 11-on-in full team scrimmage, just in terms of the plays that were called for him, but he still looked good. Andy Dalton, I got to say, has had excellent command in everything that I have seen from him, and I know Bears fans don't even want to hear that, but Andy Dalton has looked very good so far in the two earnest practices that I've seen, and will wait for to hear the results of what happened in practice today.
All of which is to be expected. Andy Dalton started ahead of him, is going to remain ahead of him, and the excitement about Justin Fields is all about what the potential is, not what the present is. And so I don't think anything's out of order here. The one thing, and I don't know that we're not far enough into this thing, but the idea that Matt Nagy has to hold Justin Fields to the one of the bars that to which he held Mitch Trubisky, become a master of all coverages, because otherwise his whatever Matt Nagy thinks he can do, he can't do if he doesn't have a guy who has mastered all the coverages. But remember, that was a big deal about that. That was his diplomatic way of saying that Mitch Trubisky is too dumb to learn NFL defenses, and we have to cut the field in half, and we have to put him on the run, and we have to give him one target, and it's always Allen Robinson. I mean, that's pretty much what happened. So I don't know that, has Nagy said that? Has he talked about mastering all coverages or given an idea where Justin Fields is in whatever he's seen, whatever he's had the Bear defense throw at Justin Fields?
He's been pretty optimistic. Even after the day that was not great 2 days ago, he was fairly optimistic about what he has seen from him. But he did say, as you guys can see, it's a little bit different when you're going full speed in the NFL. So that was his way of saying, yeah, I saw what you guys saw. I know there were some mistakes made, and it wasn't great. So I think that probably justifies everything that Matt Nagy has said to some degree, because we've all sort of fought back again. Hey, start Justin Fields. Get him out there. Mm-hmm. And Justin Fields, and look, we're 2 days into camp, but Justin Fields doesn't look like a guy who is ready to take over first string and be a dominant superstar quarterback. By the end of camp, he might. By the end of preseason, he might. And by the way, Matt Nagy did make a point of saying for the third time that, yes, starters will play more in the preseason, and you will probably see a lot of Justin Fields in those preseason games against Miami, Buffalo, and Tennessee.
I look forward to that. Let's take a break and come back. We have more of What Mark Heard. We must have more. We need more of What Mark Heard.
We will have the latest on the competitions at wide receiver. And then I think it's important to one more time hear from Eddie Goldman, number 91 for the Chicago Bears.
All righty, then. Let's remember Matt Nagy's words, his philosophy, his mantra. Be you, be honest, Beyonce. I think that's the way the T-shirt's going to go. I'm Steve Rosenblum. He's Mark Grody. Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score.
We don't have turds on this team.
I love the Bears.
Welcome in, welcome back. Steve Rosenblum, Mark Grody, Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score. Saturday Suckage, and we're doing our near award-winning segment called What Mark Heard. At the top of the hour, Mark, your BFF, Chance the Rapper, showed up at a Bulls draft event.
Mm.
I mean, we need to talk to Herb Lawrence about that, the Illini guy, the biggest Illini honk we know. We're going to do that at the top of the hour. We have some items to bring to the fans in What Are You Doing, Wegner? And we will replay Inside the Clubhouse's interview with Tony La Russa. We will do that next hour as well. So it's action-packed, as is What Mark Heard. What else did Mark Heard up at house?
Everybody wants to know who is going to be in the wide, like who is going to be of consequence as far as wide receivers are concerned beyond Allen Robinson and Darnell Mooney. First, let's hear from Matt Nagy on that core of guys.
The competition that we brought in at the wide receiver position is really good. You know, you think of a guy like Marquise Goodwin, who we brought in, and Damir Bird, and, you know, obviously having Ridley and Wim still here, and A-Rob and Mooney, and there's a lot of depth. I mean, you got other guys I didn't mention that are on our roster that are going to completely compete and go out there, and then what we got to do is you know, let them do their thing and just kind of see where they're at. But I think, like, one of the things is we're going to feel a little bit of a difference there at that position, that group, and it starts with those guys.
Well, so the Bears wide receiver core is as fast as it's ever been. These guys can all fly. Darnell Mooney, Marquise Goodwin is the fastest of the bunch. Damir Bird can fly as well. It's interesting to watch Riley Ridley, and I feel like he's out there fighting for a roster spot, and he's been very present in camp so far, which could mean one of two things: that they are want to use him more, or they're saying that we want to get one last look at you before we make a decision. So there is that, because everybody's always at, hey, what has gone on with the former fourth round pick from Georgia, and why is he never used? It feels like, okay, show us once and for all, do you have it or not? Maybe similar to Javon Wims, who is a valued special teams guy, so he may have a more direct route to the team. As far as Damir Bird and Marquise Goodwin are concerned, I think Bird is going to be the more prevalent option, especially in the slot, which is not necessarily where he's played a lot of his career. But he's had a better career than Marquise Goodwin. Goodwin didn't play last year. He opted out. So I would circle Damir Bird as probably the guy who right now I would say would be the third most productive wide receiver out of that core, with honorable mention to Marquise Goodwin, Riley Ridley, and Javon Wims.
Goodwin is believed to be the fastest, but I was going to ask, when you're talking about Bird and Goodwin, who did you see make more tough catches early on? I mean, we're not talking about a big sample size, but your first impressions are your first impressions.
Yeah, I'd say even like going back to OTAs, like he and minicamp, that Bird has been a little bit more consistent in that regard. Not that Goodwin hasn't been, but I think that Goodwin is, and fans love Goodwin because of his Olympic speed, literally Olympic speed. I think he's going to get a shot to return kicks, and I think that he's a guy too that if you like really scheme him correctly, you know what I mean? Like, he can be a guy running those fly patterns and those bombs. Like, things have to go right. You know, if you just look back at Marquise Goodwin's career, it's not been hugely productive. But, again, if Bill Lazor and Matt Nagy use him correctly, that's a straight-up weapon. I think some similarities, like the way the Bears use Cordarrelle Patterson. If you use him correctly, he can be a weapon, but I think more of the everyday work and catching and targets are going to be Damier Bird.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll look forward to that. Anything that brings speed and threats and looking deep before they look short, that would be a wonderful upgrade, a wonderful bit of entertainment for Bears fans.
All right, last cut I have for you is, and I played this earlier this week, but I think it's interesting to hear because Eddie Goldman going into camp was probably maybe the number one story because he had sat out OTAs, he sat out the mandatory minicamp, and of course he opted out last year because of COVID-19. Here is Eddie Goldman answering all the questions that you've been wanting to know the answers to.
It was really challenging. You know, when I made the decision, you know, I weighed all of my options and, you know, just thinking I would be away from the game for a year is just, it really took a toll on me, especially when I watched the season and how it played out and how we, you know, made the playoffs and everything. You know, it was something to experience, but it wasn't really, you know, a fun thing.
Hey, can you tell us what went into the decision for you just not to be here during the off season and everything?
It was, you know, you had the COVID protocols and then also some family issues. I will say, the only regret that I do have is just the fact that, you know, my teammates went to battle without me. You know, that'll be my only regret.
And Eddie Goldman does look good. He is in shape. He said he spent his time when he opted out working out a ton. He looks the part, and quite frankly, from what I've seen of him watching him closely in camp so far, he doesn't look any different in terms of his play, which is at a high level than he's ever looked. So I think the Bears are good with Eddie Goldman.
I hope so. He's a huge key. If they stop the run, they get off the field, the offense gets on the field more, you have your way with opponents. That is, Eddie Goldman is so important in that situation. But you know what I was thinking? Tuesday is the first day in pads, isn't that right?
Yep, the Soldier Field Day, family day or family night, whatever you want to call it.
So Tuesday and Wednesday will be, in my world, my first two questions are Justin Fields. The second one is Eddie Goldman. What is it like when Eddie Goldman gets hit again? What is it like when he delivers a blow? What is it? What is his body like the day after? And Justin Fields. Maybe they can't touch quarterbacks, but they can certainly touch the targets, and they can make you run around. And I think those are the top two questions. I know we talked about receivers, and you got your eye on other people. But for me, the guy closest to the snap of the ball on that defense is so important. And the guy who's taking the snap, who's supposed to be the future, that when they first hit, those would be the two guys I'd want to know most about. And that and the day after, how do they feel the day after?
It's such a great point because we spoke to all the coordinators yesterday, in particular defense and offense, and both Bill Lazor and Sean Desai, when we asked them to evaluate individual players, they said it's really tough for us to give you some sort of concrete answer pre-pads, that once the pads go on, we'll give you a better idea. And that is the truth, and I'm glad that you brought that up because that has to be the disclaimer to everything that I'm talking about right now, that it's not a lot to go on when they have and put no pads so far. These guys are out there wearing helmets and shorts, and that's it.
All right. We completed another near award-winning segment of What Mark Heard. We're going to take a break when we come back. The Bulls did a thing this week, and it was so big, Chance the Rapper showed up. And it was so big that it involved an Illini player. We're talking to the biggest Illini honk we know. That's Herb Lawrence. So we'll come back and talk some hoops. Next, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.